You're listening to the Root Causing Health Podcast. I'm Nick Andre, and together with my partner Nathan Owens, we are delving deep into the science to answer the question, what causes chronic disease? We'll cover the basics, talk about our hypotheses, and bring you the best guests from around the medical and research community. If you like what we have here, please join us over at rootcausinghealth.com, where you'll find our blog and other resources. You can also support us on Patreon to fund our research and get early access to all of our content.
All right, so Dr. Sean O'Mara is the founder of MedCon Wellness, a not-for-profit medical clinic, and he's been using MRI scans to track patients' progress in losing visceral fat and achieving optimal health and wellness. And he also puts how many push-ups and pull-ups he can do on his website, which is pretty awesome.
I forgot I did that.
So we're wondering if you can give us your story. How did you end up kind of taking this different route into health? Did you have like personal experiences with poor health or other things that led you to investigate this?
Sure. Well, I trained in the Army as an emergency medicine physician. So that required 4 years of medical school and then another 4 years of residency in emergency medicine. I actually finished my residency back in 2002. And exclusively practiced as an emergency medicine physician for approximately 17 years. And then I had an occasion where I was exposed to a patient that came in to be seen, and he was unusually healthy, and it led to a discussion about why and what he would eat. And at that time, this was about 2000 and I'd say 2010, 2011 time period, he said he was paleo.
What did you mean by unusually healthy?
Yeah. So first of all, he wasn't overweight. He had very nice muscular build. He had an unusual glow about his skin. So I actually thought at first that he might be jaundiced. So I remember palpating his liver to get an idea if he had an enlarged liver. And so I finally just came out and said, but his whites of his eyes were really white, which is inconsistent with elevated levels of bilirubin, or what we call jaundice. So I came out and said, do you eat an unusual diet? So he had this glow about him, and people that eat a lot of vegetables can have this kind of a tinge to their skin. And he said, yeah, I'm actually paleo. And I said, well, what is paleo? I'd never heard of it at the time. So he told me a little bit about it, and he said one interesting fact, and I think you guys will like this. He shared that Sergey Brin had recently decided to go paleo because Google had tracked how paleo was performing on the internet. Then they found that people that were Googling paleo spent more time reading about it than any other diet that people were Googling at the time. So it suggested on an individual level, people that were researching a diet, they found that more interesting and therefore inferentially more important to them. The second thing that was persuasive to Google, Sergey Brin, was the fact that the contacts of those people that they also track started to behave and do the same thing. They started to Google the paleo diet and spend a lot of time on it. So this suggested what is endorsement. So on an individual level, people found it was important. And then secondly, they endorsed it to their contacts. So that right there said, Google thinks this is important. Sergey Brin did that kind of analysis. I said, that is really interesting. So I said, I better check it out from a physician standpoint.
None of the Weight Watchers people were phoning home to all their contacts to tell them how effective it was, basically what was going on?
No, apparently not. And judging from their stock, how it's been doing recently, I don't think that's turned around for them either. So I decided at that time, after reading, doing some self-study about a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet then called paleo, to make a personal choice myself to start eating paleo. And I basically have continued since that time, now adopting intermittent fasting and a ketogenic lifestyle.
Were there particular problems that you had that you noticed going away personally when you started that? Was weight a problem for you?
Oh, yeah, very much so. So I was obese. I was overweight. I'd got out of the Army. I had promised myself that I would not become a ex-Army fat guy. And that's, in fact, what I did. I became overweight. And along with obesity came other problems. So I was pre-diabetic. I'd been already given a glucose challenge, glucose tolerance test, and identified as pre-diabetic. I had high blood pressure. I had eczema so bad my lesions would bleed, and I had blood-stained T-shirts and clothing and sheets from my eczema. I had restless leg syndrome. My legs would kick all night long, keeping my wife awake. When I wasn't kicking my legs, I was snoring. I had obstructive sleep apnea. I had a severe gastroesophageal reflux disease diagnosed by histopathology biopsies of my esophagus, where I actually developed Barrett's esophagus, which is a pre-malignant, pre-cancerous condition with changes in your mucosal lining of your esophagus. I had a loss of my memory, where my memory was being impaired. I would tell my wife one thing 2 hours later. I'd walk in the room, tell her again that very same thing. She would say, you already told me that. And I was absolutely adamant that I had never told her that. It was really losing my memory. I had an enlarged prostate, where I was having to wake up three or more times a night to pee. And I could only describe my ability to urinate as it would just fall out of me. It was gravity. It was no longer an ability to control a stream or to hurry things along. And the surprising thing was, when I went on that high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, it wasn't because health claims were made. It wasn't because, I had thought that, any of these problems would go away. I made that decision just because it seemed like such a sensible diet. And 1 year later, I noticed all of those problems had gone away. And I had previously undergone a carotid ultrasound diagnosing atherosclerotic cardiovascular plaques, 35% on my right, 33% on my left. And it was 2 years after that, I underwent an MRI scan, and I had seen those lesions had actually reversed and resolved because of my lifestyle choices. And it's the cumulative effect of going on a free diet, changing my lifestyle, being able to go off all my medicines, being able to go through an evening without having to wake up anymore to pee, and now being able to pee again like an 18-year-old, with all of these medical problems being resolved, that I got more than just passionate about trying to get our country more healthy. I became very upset with conventional healthcare and the system that had ignored all these things. And I felt that I just kind of stumbled into it just because I had this encounter with this one patient. And that set me into an effort on my own to start researching and study dietary interventions, finding out about the quantified self movement and biohackers and this citizen scientist community that's out there, with individuals that, in my opinion, are making far more contributions to the improvement of humanity than everything probably all physicians and MDs had ever put together. So as far as measuring how you can improve health and getting people healthy compared to the conventional approach in healthcare, where physicians seem to be completely focused and preoccupied with simply treating disease, happy with the existence of disease provided they treat it, and really not even imagining that you could actually reverse disease through lifestyle changes.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's interesting to hear how different people who have ended up here, how we all heard about it at first, because it was never from the guidelines or anything. It's always from a friend or a doctor or someone who just casually mentioned it. But one of the things we noticed was that you'd been looking at MRI specifically as a proxy here. I know, obviously, Ivor Cummins' adage is that, if you don't measure it, it don't get fixed, is kind of how it works in medicine. So it's very helpful to have things that you can track. And there are a lot of different things that we track, whether that's like a visceral adipose tissue from a DEXA scan or even just a waist circumference or other interesting things. But kind of what led you to look into that? Was there research that was particularly helpful or that people listening might find interesting to dig in that you read at first, or and how much of it was kind of a novel things that you were looking into?
Yeah. So about 2 or 3 years, I had been high fat, low carb, paleo, doing this largely on my own as a physician. No real way to verify or measure any particular metrics or biomarkers at that time. I certainly had felt better. I'd gone through diagnostic testing and a lot of these issues had gone away from a disease standpoint. But what I was most profoundly moved by was a physician that I'd met just by chance, who was from China, born in China, moved to the United States and became a licensed physician, trained in preventive medicine and epidemiology. And he was the one that invited me to come to his research practice and have my visceral fat scanned. Well, I didn't know too much about visceral fat as an emergency medicine physician, and I hadn't read much of anything about it on the internet. And so I decided to accept his request. I came to his facility, and he had his own MRI scanner that he had been previously conducting research on leasing the scanner. And as it turned out, the owner of the MRI scanner, it was a diagnostic center, sadly declared bankruptcy. They end up coming down with cancer. So he was able to get the MRI scanner, just buy it. And so he just did research. So he invited me to come in and have my visceral fats measured. And there I was going through the scanner, terrified. And I thought, you know, I've really worked hard for 2 to 3 years. I've gone on this high fat, low carbohydrate diet. And I'm going to be so discouraged if I see a lot of disease in my body. So without any discussion, the MRI tech came in. I wasn't introduced to them. They just scanned me. And after I finished the scanning, the tech looked down at me and he said, "You are obscenely healthy." And I got to tell you, those were some of the most gratifying, reassuring words I've ever heard in my life. And that was an epiphany for me. And I realized the power of this MRI scanner that allowed you to take a look inside. And so subsequent to those words being shared, the images were subsequently shared with me. And I was able to see actually inside my body how much fat and muscle tissue I had, the ratios of that. And also looking at fat around my heart and then my cerebral arteries and my carotid arteries. And it was just a fantastic window that allowed me to appreciate that this is what's been missing in medicine. Diagnostic studies to take a look at biomarkers connected to health and reversal of disease and the optimization of health. So I was in a short period of time after, you know, demonstrating my enthusiasm for what he was up to, I was invited to be a part of the research effort there in Minneapolis. And to this day, it's now almost five years since that particular point. I'm still actively involved in that research practice and enjoying every minute of it.
That's awesome. So what have you learned from the research practice? I think I heard you say on another talk that you have scan data from 4,000 patients, which seems like it would be pretty interesting to look at for trends and patterns. And then also, do you do any other tests or labs on people commonly?
Yeah, great tests, great question. So we started off focusing on visceral fat. Early on in the research, we saw the association between visceral fat and lumbar disease, people that were having lumbar pain. So the research actually and with the MRI started focusing actually by on the lumbar spine and lumbar disease. And just by chance, they happened to see the association of all this visceral fat with the most symptomatic people. So it caught the interest of the investigator. And most of the time, you what's called cone down. You just focus in on a particular area. But, you know, to save a little time, they didn't bother coning down and they just allowed all that other tissue. And, you know, sometimes mistakes like that happen, and it allowed the discovery of visceral fat in association to symptomatic lumbar disease, degenerative disc disease, and degenerative joint disease. So we started then looking specifically at visceral fat. We then, after collecting studies, numerous studies on visceral fat, started looking at pericardial fat, which is fat around the heart. And we also took a look at subcutaneous fat and its relationship between these different bodies of fat to muscle tissue. And as unhealthy people accumulate more fat, they also develop atrophy or sarcopenia, reduction of their muscle tissue. So the large number of studies that we did with visceral fat and pericardial fat also resulted in opportunities to work with these patients where we reversed this visceral fat accumulation. And from their experience, you know, describing what would happen, resolution of various different medical conditions, they began to report something very interesting, that their memory improved, their ability to process information. In this particular case, a lot of these individuals that were participating in this particular study were business executives. They were people who were willing to pay cash to get a study like this done, because insurance companies are not at all interested in reversing chronic disease. So people had to pay out of pocket to get this kind of analysis done. And they started reporting as C-suite, C-level, CEOs, CFOs, COOs of companies, that they could process their information more quickly and with an improved error rate. So that led, based on their own inquiry to us, whether reduction of visceral fat could actually help improve people's cognitive performance, allowed us to question and start scanning the head. So we started looking specifically at the head to see if we could capture any changes as visceral fat goes away. And what we saw happening was the cerebral arteries that showed evidence of atherosclerotic cardiovascular plaques, and I think I sent you some images of this, that were occluded, began to open up. And we'd never seen anything like that. And I scan people all the time in the ER with MRIs, doing with contrast. And we just report that disease and we'd push it to primary care doctors. And I would ask these primary care doctors, what do you do when you, when you get these reports of people with, you know, disease and clogged arteries in the brain? They just say, well, we start them on statins.
Yeah. That statin's going to fix that right up. Yeah.
Yeah. No. What was remarkable is that we followed these patients using a high fat, low carbohydrate diet. And we do a lot of other interventions, which I sent on to you guys as well. And what we thought would be years, you know, to open up those clogged arteries, because it's basically years that those arteries presumably are getting occluded over a period of time. But no, we're seeing this in a matter of months, these arteries opening up through lifestyle choices.
Which arteries were you scanning in particular?
Well, we scanned an area of the brain, the arterial system of the brain, called the Circle of Willis. So these are cerebral arteries, or basically the main arterial system within supplying blood to the brain. And not surprisingly, the number one site of most strokes are the middle cerebral artery, and that's where we tend to see a lot of this occlusion. And we were able to capture this, you know, memorialize it in MRI studies and bring people back. And that's why I like the MRI, is when its resolution is so good, but two, because it's non-ionizing, meaning it doesn't use any radiation. We can scan people every day if we want. And in fact, we have done that. We've scanned people on Friday, have them go and, you know, they fall away and start eating a bunch of rice and cake in a wedding over the weekend. And we bring them back on Monday and we can scan them again and show them the increase in visceral fat. So it's pretty exciting, the powers and the possibilities that you can get with taking a look at measuring the accumulation of disease and its reversal. And so that's why it's been such a fulfilling 5 years using the MRI scanner for me, taking a look at lifestyle interventions and how people live their lives to either accumulate disease or how they make healthier choices to eliminate disease. And that the other thing, I guess, that your most important thing I'd like to share with your audience, actually, about the reverse of chronic disease, is we saw something that happened to individuals that were able to reverse chronic disease that we didn't anticipate, and that is human performance improved across the board. And the reason why I think that's important is, honestly, I think that's a leverageable area that we need to help make progress with reversing chronic disease in our country, because people, let's face it, it's not the sexiest topic in the world to get people healthy. But if you can get them performing better, now you got a handle to get a purchase on a lot more people and their lives, because a lot of my clients just weren't very interested in getting healthy. But if I could show them how they could perform better and they had a livelihood that was predicated upon performance, meaning their annual income was connected to how well they perform, now that would speak to them and motivate them. And that's what I'm out promoting.
What metrics exactly did you use to try and track that?
Well, that's the difficult thing. Like, how do you track human performance? Not really into it. It's, something that you could track intelligence through IQ testing, memory. There's a lot of intelligence and neurocognitive performance tests that are being done for traumatic brain injury and PTSD connected to the military community. That's not an area I'm super interested in. So what I do is I identify the biomarkers to reverse disease. I tell people the interventions to do, and they can track their own performance. So typically what, gets reported is their own memory improves, their error rates improve, they make more money, they get more work done. If they're athletes, they start running faster. So we have Olympic athletes that work with us. They lift more weights, they're stronger, they're faster. And, if they're in the business community, they just start looking better. So we started tracking a lot of things. We'll take photographs of people's faces, of their bodies. Of course, we do MRI images. We're trying to track as many different areas on their body to follow, because I think the future of medicine, healthcare, is going towards more in line with quantified self and biohacking, where people will be armed with information, metrics that they can follow that allow them, independent of working with a hospital system, high-priced physicians, limited by insurance companies that dictate what they can and cannot do and test, and individuals educated to biomarkers that they can follow both on their body and inside their body are going to have far better results than spending probably hundreds of thousands of dollars in the healthcare system ultimately, and ending up, 60, 70, 80 years old with a bag full of medicine going into ERs looking like Hades. So the other interesting aspect to the MRI imagery is I would pay attention to people's bodies that would come in. And it first came up with their faces. They would come back and I would see changes in their faces. But I have an unusual ability to detect changes in the face because I have Asperger's. And so I have limitations, sort of like a blanket. You pull a blanket up, exposes the feet, but covers the head. You pull the blanket down, covers. So I have certain strengths and weaknesses. My weaknesses are I'm not so good with interpreting facial expressions and nuances with feelings. But I'm awesome in tracking little teeny tiny changes in skin and on the face. So these faces started to change, and I kept having the MRI tech do MRIs on people's faces because I'm like, my God, their faces changed. We got to figure out what's going on with their face. And then I started to realize that other things would change too. So cutaneous manifestations like telangiectasias, basically spider veins and manifestations along the face. I even picked up that blackheads, this is super interesting, blackheads on people's noses were changing. So these aren't really blackheads. What they are sebaceous filaments. So people have pores on their skin. The pores are natural. They fill with oil. and then they oxidize and they turn black. So it's really not dirt. Oxidation, guys. What does that sound like? Reactive oxygen species. So guess what you can start watching? Resolution in nasal blackheads. So the sebum created by these glands are less oxidatable. They're less vulnerable to oxidation from the air. And so what we have seen is resolution in nasal blackheads. Now, that may not sound like a big deal, but it's kind of interesting as a connection to health, because let's put you guys back to 16, 17, 18 years old. Your first romantic encounter, maybe with kissing, somebody, and you're making the move and you're going in a little close, and suddenly you see on that person a lot of nasal blackheads. What does nature tell you to do? Attracted or not? So attraction really is an interesting, I think, aspect to health. And the fact that nasal blackheads are present or can be reversed is an interesting biomarker. It's one of many that we have figured out. I pay attention to all these unusual manifestations in the skin because of my Asperger's. And as we reverse visceral fat and we reverse pericardial fat and open up arteries, we would see these cutaneous changes in the skin. So nasal blackheads are one. Changes in toenails and fingernails, especially toenails. Oftentimes, as we age, they become, I call them the canary and the coal mine, because there's a Chinese proverb that the Chinese say you die with your feet first, meaning that's kind of the first area you start to experience disease. So the cutaneous changes in toenails as they discolor and they change appearance reflects aging and chronic disease. And more precisely, in my opinion, is a lack of blood flow. So the toenails being the furthest tissue body from the heart, they start to manifest evidence of disease. And so I would see these changes in the toenails, not particularly the coolest thing to look at, but as a researcher, I couldn't ignore the fact that I could get these people's toenails looking better. So they would have fungemia, they'd have, fungal, onchomycosis, toenail changes from fungus. Well, if you get the blood flow better there, it simply goes away. Or you could take a bunch of pills that could damage your liver and you have to get a bunch of blood tests. I don't understand this logic, but people, really want pills to kind of get rid of toenail fungus. It's simply because they don't know that they could treat the underlying problem, let that toenail fungus go away, and oh, by the way, get blood flow better to your heart, to your organs, to your brain, and increase human performance, your whole lifestyle, and your overall level of health. So those are just a few of the biomarkers that I've observed and taken a look at the changes in the skin and outside the body as I took a look at changes going on inside the body.
I have myself been increasingly interested in this because I've become more and more convinced that a lot of the things that we popularly consider to be aging in our population are actually just appearance of diabetic pathology in one way or another, and this same sort of chronic disease manifesting in the skin. Like, I think most carnivores who have ever tried this diet will have realized that they've started to get like offhand comments to them that they like look better. And it's weird. Like, you'll see people 2 years apart and they'll just be like, "You look different," or something like that. And you'll be like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean by that? And they're like, "Just different. And I was like, "Interesting." But I did have one question. If there have been any, are there any sort of outliers where like you've seen a discordance between these metrics when you did an MRI versus you looked at the external symptoms, or did everything kind of seem to fall into a line with this metric? Because there was some concern when we talked to, I think, Gabor, that sometimes in later stage disease, there can be insulin resistance in the visceral adipose tissue. So maybe the correlation, and I don't know, maybe that's like a later stage thing where like they definitely have the disease and they already have problems. But I was just wondering if you had any insight on that, whether there was discordance.
Nothing significant. I think some people I've noticed are a little bit more refractory to resolution of visceral fat. And so I'll ask them and they'll swear that they're cutting out carbohydrates. And then discussions usually will turn towards how are you sleeping? How much are you drinking? How much stress you have? So we can see the persistence of visceral fat and inflammation, and a reduction in the resolution of disease, and a tempering of the immediate health benefits that come from lifestyle changes if people have those particular areas. So there are a lot of things beyond diet that can influence visceral fat that we noticed, but I have not seen resolution of visceral fat, resolution of problems with sleeping, drinking, and stress that did not have dramatic changes cutaneously in on people's bodies and in terms of how they feel, resolution of medical conditions. But I would like to comment on the faces. One kind of I think it's very interesting observation I've had with people whose face changes. I record a lot of these changes with patients' permission. I show, you know, before and after changes. And what's interesting to me is I'm fascinated by some people that say, "Oh my God, look at that." And other people go, "Well, maybe a little bit." So, you know, why do people have different tastes? Well, what's interesting to me is the latter ones, if you are working with them, don't have very good results. They are really slow to either adopt lifestyle changes or to get results. They are clearly late adopters. But the person that looks at that and detects a profound change and is really, you know, moved by that, they're more the early adopter mindset, and they get much better results. They adopt those interventions. So I think there's something about the human brain and how you interpret change in the appearance of people that dictates and can predict how quickly you're going to respond to lifestyle changes and your own efforts to become more healthy. So you can be aware of that yourself, you know, when you're talking to people and you're showing off change. The ones that change, that see change a lot, I think they have an advantage to work with. And I'm very excited to work with those kind of individuals. The ones that, you know, look at the change and they kind of poo-poo it or don't see much, that's a lot of heavy lifting for me as a researcher to work with them. So I try to identify individuals that I would describe as alphas, people who are more leadership oriented, people that are more competitive, people who work harder, people who are willing to go out and basically hunt and gather when it's hotter and colder and more difficult and more dangerous than the average person. And I think they are very valuable people to work with. They have interesting, probably genetics, were we to take a look at that. And I'm also interested in seeing the potential contribution that the microbiome, their microbiome, might play in their particular personality traits as well.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting and important to have those hooks, because I know that, like, I've suffered from a carbohydrate addiction in my past, and it, like, you need a lot of different motivators and forces and checks and things in order to help a lot of times if you're working with these problems, and having more things, especially like for someone who isn't clued into perhaps the aesthetic changes in their their cutaneous tissue, like perhaps there are other things that we can do to get them motivated. But I know from personal experience that there's just, you know, the more ways that you can track it, you know, telling people that a scale isn't a great proxy, and maybe you might want to measure around your waist or something like that. That I think there are a lot of interesting ways to motivate people to do these things, because in reality, these changes are very difficult, and if you don't have a very strong motivator, you will probably fail, just given the adversity within our larger environment.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had been able to isolate, because one of the things is, like, Nathan and I are pretty much carnivore, and we do that because we are relatively certain that a lot of the problems come from processed food and processed plants, but it's not necessarily clear with the panoply of agricultural products that we have. Most of them have been selectively bred to the point that they probably are outside, or that they may fall outside the range that our digestive system expects from an evolutionary perspective. And so we have just decided we're going to cut them out, and we haven't died yet. So that's kind of what we're rolling with at the time. I mean, I have probably a little bit more flexibility. They might call me like carnivore adjacent, but have you done any work to try and isolate what aspects of diet more specifically influence these outcome metrics? Obviously, some people view like a ketogenic diet or a paleo diet as overly restrictive, especially like a carnivore diet would be considered overly restrictive because it removes a lot of things that people think might benefit, although there are differing perspectives from, you know, is a whole grain that has been totally unperturbed going to cause problems to your microbiome versus a plant with anti-nutrients versus a more processed plant like a flour or even like a whole wheat flour. And there's a lot of difficulty in trying to answer that problem of specifically if we turned each individual food item on or off within people, how would that affect our health? And I don't know if you've done any further deep digging into this area or whether you've seen any trends within your patients.
Well, my initial thought on it is that I think it's enormously complex. Yeah, the individual food items and I think artificial intelligence, machine learning, looking at hundreds of millions of people is going to allow us to explore far more effectively than nutritional studies and the limitation that that particular effort brings. So I'm excited to see the emergence and participation in this space of IT guys like you. And I would love to get more people in the artificial intelligence realm and the IT community to start taking a look at that, because I think it's going to be super exciting. However, I move, in some generalities, and I am of the opinion that grains are a problem for us, and I have eliminated them from my diet. I get my clients to do the same thing, and it's hard to say, you know, exactly what contribution that elimination plays, other than if we keep them in, problems persist. And one of the interesting things about grains is that it seems to me that that there is an attraction to them that is difficult to break people from, and they are almost addictive to grains. I mean, I can get people to stop broccoli, but try to get them to give up grains, and you got an argument on your hands.
Yeah, I know that very well.
So one of the, when you say, you know, addictive nature to carbs, one of the things that I have found in my experience, and it's become now part of my practice as an objective, is if people have an addiction or a strong attraction to processed foods, particularly simple carbs, is that I work very quickly to try to optimize their microbiome. And I know the microbiome is a big black box. But the healthier you are, the healthier your microbiome is. And so I work to try to get people to first stop harming their microbiome by eating processed foods that have food preservatives in there, disrupting those little delicate and precious microbes that are down there. And secondly, I get them to make, you know, adopt the healthiest lifestyle as possible to help strengthen and improve the existence of microbes, beneficial microbes down there. And then I send in what I liken to borrow from my military training, special operators. And so what I send is Navy SEAL Team 6 down into the stomach, the gastrointestinal tract, by having people adopt what has been part of a tradition of populations of people that live long lives and are usually healthy, and that is fermented foods. So probiotic fermented foods, I get people to eat. Now, when I get people to do that and stay with it, they never fall away. So Dr. Peter Attia, if you ever hear this podcast, there you go. The reason why I'm fascinated with Peter Attia's brilliant mind. He wears these t-shirts with discipline. The guy has a lot of discipline, but you know, he's very honest. He can't stop eating bread, and he reports he eats pizza, you know, for breakfast sometimes when he's sleep deprived. And I'm astounded. I'm like, how could this guy who knows so much about these harmful foods go ahead and do that? And yet, I am completely resilient. I have zero cravings for these foods, and I get my patients to do that by optimization of their microbiome. So I think that's Peter's challenge, is that he needs to spend more time optimizing his microbiome, getting more probiotic fermented foods in there, stop eating fermented foods. And the reason is you can become healthy. And you could get rid of these bad guys, but we live in a world where these microbes are ubiquitously present. So you go to the store, you touch a grocery, you know, cart, you open a door, you touch anything, you wipe sweat, you sneeze, you got those microbes on your face. They eventually go in your mouth. They go down there, and so they'll die if you got fermented foods in there because they're opportunistic. So, you know, these other organisms that are down that are benign and beneficial, you know, outcompete them for resources. But if you feed them cereal, simple carbs, sugars, and things along those lines, then they're going to have, you know, a wild reproductive session within you. And make no mistake about it, these organisms have existed, outdated us. And the only way they can survive is because they don't have legs, arms, feet, eyes, and other senses to go out, climb out of your body, is to influence your thinking and induce cravings for you to feed them, because otherwise they are surely going to die. So I like to educate my clients about the amazing and significant role the microbiome plays with health and helping patients and clients I work with become more resilient to stop eating lousy, unhealthy food.
That's really interesting. And that definitely kills me when I'm listening to Peter Tia's podcast occasionally, like when he's chatting
Does he sincerely eat pizza?
Yeah, he was chatting near Benzali about type 2 diabetes. And then they were talking at the end of the podcast about where they were going to go to get Indian food for dinner.
What?
Yeah.
Is that why he fell off the keto bandwagon? Because he said he couldn't eat keto anymore.
He makes up for it by taking rapamycin and metformin and fasting once a quarter with the nothing burger, keto, week of fasting, week of keto kind of thing.
He takes metformin to really? What?
Yeah, he takes metformin and rapamycin daily.
How do I not know this? Maybe I don't listen to his podcast enough.
Yeah. Well, he's a little crazy.
He takes metformin daily?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He's not a fan of the microbiome. And, you know, I don't want to unfairly quote Peter, but, The last attribution I saw from Peter on the microbiome was that it's basically we don't know enough about it to really leverage it. Oh, good Lord, man! You are way smarter than I am. You know, don't allow that to intimidate you. You know, make some healthier choices. Study. You know, you try an intervention, you measure it. You try an intervention, you measure it. Yeah, we don't have it mastered, and we probably won't have it mastered in a lifetime. But it's my, you know, position that we can do more than nothing with it. And I, you know, in my efforts so far with getting people to optimize it to the extent that I do, their cravings go away. And Peter, why not try it? You know, why not do what I just suggested and see if your cravings, and suddenly do you find yourself able to turn away from your kid's cereal and the junky stuff that you've reported. I'm glad that you're honest about that. But at the same time, you know, don't you think there's some people out there that are looking for some heroes? I think we need some role models out there that, you know, give people some hope that they can get through these cravings. Because I can get my, if there's anybody listening that really wants to get rid of cravings, you know, come and get connected with me out here in Minneapolis. Look me up and we can do that. But I think that's what's been missing in healthcare. Cause think about when you go to a physician and they're going to tell you about being healthy. And usually, our physicians, unfortunately, are not role models for health. We have role models in everything, basketball, football, the best attorneys in the country, the best consultants, the best, you know, IT people. Why don't we have role models for health? You know, and how discouraging it must be to patients when they go in and they have a physician that looks so awful.
We just need to look towards Nick's doctor, Ted Naiman, who's ripped and looks pretty good, or Paul Saladino, or any of these guys. We have a couple of them. They're up and coming, I guess.
Oh yeah. Well, now they're starting to come out. And I'm no slouch either. I'm in the military, and I can outperform pull-ups and push-ups than any soldier, at least that I've run into. And I'm 56 years old.
You've got me beat with 33 pull-ups. That's pretty crazy. I gotta work on that.
So, to your point, though, we do need more physicians, and they are starting to come out there to be those kind of role models, because I think it's really necessary if we're going to be effective. And, the other interesting aspect to these role models is that, I think we wear our health on our faces. And 30,000 years ago, we would encounter strangers, Homo sapiens, that we didn't know. They weren't part of our tribe and our clan. And all we would have had to look at was their face. It would have had animal skins in their body, probably. But we are pre-programmed to take a look at that face and decide, are they good hunter-gatherers? Either to invite them to join our tribe, or if our tribe has gotten lazy and just not good at hunting-gathering anymore, and we're looking for a new place to hang out, new group of people, then we're attracted to their hunter-gatherer face to join their tribe or their clan or whatever we called it back then. So what I try to leverage within the business community and leaders who are trying to become influencers is you want a hunter-gatherer face. And by the way, you guys have hunter-gatherer faces. You look healthy, and you want to be in that space where you have that lean hunter-gatherer look that says to people, I know how to hunt and gather, and I know how to lead. And if you're somebody who's just a performer, not so much, so I don't think important that how you look, but if you're going to lead and you're going to influence, then you want to know people that you talk to are going to want to know that you know how to do that. And I think that's why it's important that, people leverage biology in the sphere of influence. If you're going to be a leader, if you're going to run a company, if you're going to be an influencer in social media, yeah, you're going to want to have optimized health so that you wear that on your face and people are more inclined to listen to what you're saying.
Evolutionarily, it's obvious that it would have been incredibly important for us to be able to detect subtle changes in health. When you go to reproduce with someone, you want to know how healthy they are. Like it is directly important to the survival of your offspring that you mate with someone who's healthy. And so, I mean, I've just found it very interesting with me. Like all of a sudden I have a jawbone, and then I'm like, wait, why doesn't anyone else have a jawbone? And there are all these like interesting little changes that it's actually pretty maddening, because when I go on the subway, that's really all I can think about now. And I have to like distract myself listening to a podcast or something. Otherwise, I'm just going to be obsessed over how much diabetic pathology I see in everyone. But
you've got me looking at people's limbal rings now.
That's awesome. I walk around Mall of America, which is the big shopping mall out here in Minneapolis. And everybody that walks by me, I'm doing a facial analysis on them. And I glance down at their abdominal girth and, do a visual gross estimation of the visceral fat that they have within their abdomen. So, yeah, I'm a walking supercomputer, just taking a look at people. And that's what I do. And I think 30,000, 20,000 years ago, that's what we would have done. And it's absolutely connected to reproduction. So we are attracted to prospects for mating based on how healthy they are for survival of the fittest. Nature puts that software in us. So if you're a young guy or girl in the market to get married and to have a significant other, get yourself healthy. You optimally become healthy. You're willing to leverage the power of biology and evolutionary attraction in prospects who are going to be more attracted to you. You can be as clever and as funny as you like, but it's biology that's going to be the operative force. And we see fertility issues improving, people reproductive values improving as well when they become more healthy. I often wonder why fertility specialists don't spend time working to try to optimize health. One is they probably don't know how to do it because it's not taught to us in medical school, nor is it distributed in the medical journals. But two, sadly to say, they don't make money. Nobody's figured out how to make money when you sit down and talk to people about what to eat and how to exercise. That's not revenue generating. But if you do some in vitro fertilization or some other, you know, procedure, then there's CPT coding and you can make some real money off that. So, you know, I would, anybody listening that has fertility as an issue, I would say get yourself optimally healthy, get rid of your visceral fat, get educated, do quantified self biohack before you go and spend a lot of money on fertilization reproductive specialists.
So you mentioned, you know, training, how people can diet and exercise. So you, that leads to the exercise question, I guess. You mentioned in one of your talks that you had a patient who was seeing you who was running 10 miles a day, 5 days a week, and still had a lot of visceral fat and subcutaneous fat and wasn't really making progress. So you had them switch to high intensity sprinting instead of that chronic running every day. And they lost like 2 pounds of visceral fat and a bunch of subcutaneous fat and maybe even put on some muscle. Do you know, why do you think that is? I think I have an idea and I think Nick will speak to that next, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're not entirely sure other than anecdotally, that's what happens when we get our clients sprinting. And so across the board, that is one of the universal interventions that we have our clients do. Now, in some cases, you know, we have some morbidly obese people that we're working with. So to say that we get them sprinting at the outset would probably be a little bit of a stretch. Getting them up out of chairs and walking around is a beginning. And then we start people that are old and infirmed with slow sprinting up hills, you know, where they don't have to have the sophisticated biomechanical movements of joints moving as quickly. They're just kind of a slow, hard effort up a hill, a little bit safer and easier to do. But anecdotally, we see reduction in visceral fat, and in combination, oftentimes, it's being done with a lot of things. In that particular case, the reason why I share that is that it was the only intervention. It was the only thing that changed in 2 months in that person's baseline scan. And then 2 months, it wasn't even 2 months, it was like just a little short of 2 months, that we had them stop doing the aerobic long distance running and substitute in place the sprinting. And Nathan is correct, they lost visceral fat and they actually improved, increased their muscle. We were able to quantify the hypertrophy of the muscle tissues within the abdominal region, indicating, you know, greater production of their dominant rectus muscles, oblique muscles, and their whole body shape changed. They became jacked, you know.
Wow.
We had to, you know, I had to make sure that guy wasn't using steroids because his change was so dramatic with the impact. Now, that change happens very frequently, but, you know, what's unusual about that case is that there were no other changes. So other people were having them change their diet, were having to optimize their their sleep, other things. So we can't so conclusively say the sprinting has had such a dramatic impact. But yeah, there's not a client that doesn't come to my clinic that I'm not working with to optimize their health by introducing them to sprinting. And my thought process, and I'm intrigued to hear what you guys are, is it's a survival skill. So if we look back and try to figure out what do we really need to be doing is what we need to survive. And what we need to survive is not so much what we need to survive today, but what genetically we need to survive 20, 30,000 more years ago, from at least before then, when our genetics and our physiology and our metabolism was being created. And back then, what we were doing is we had to run away from animals trying to kill us, run to another animal that we were trying to eat, and run to another organism that might have been trying to kill one of our children, our offspring, or our mate. So sprinting was absolutely a survival skill. And so that's why I think it has a role. It's necessary because it's part of our lifestyle. And when you sprint, it's almost the near perfect form of exercise. I've read articles where it uses virtually every muscle of your body, and I would have to agree. My even my biceps when I'm sprinting get pumped with blood. All my muscles fill up with blood in a very short period of time. So I find it an enormously high yield on an investment in a short exercise.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think I'm going to start adding more sprinting to my workout. I did some sprints up and down the street the other day after I listened to your talk.
One of the things that I worry about is that a lot of people are doing, I think a lot of people exercise because they're motivated by calories, which I think is, it's one of the reasons I like bothers me to go to the gym, because I see everyone, overweight people on the elliptical, just trying to like, just do endurance exercise for like 60 minutes at a time. And I'm suspicious that, I don't really have any evidence to back it up, but I'm suspicious that there are bad modalities of exercise. Like when I typically go to the gym, I do a relatively short, high intensity resistance training type circuit, and then I leave. You know, I don't sit there for 90 minutes. And I'm suspicious that there are ways that you can push this system in ways that are probably actively detrimental to our health long term. I think that the popular opinion is just more is always better, always, 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 always with exercise. And I just don't think that that doesn't seem right to me intuitively. And
yeah.
Maybe someday I'll have more data to back it up. But that's why these anecdotes, like you say, are interesting.
Well, I think I have some data to back that up, which is that I found some research, and this is kind of my hypothesis as to why the guy lost some visceral fat running, is that when you run at over 70% of your VO2 max, let's say, you start to induce intestinal ischemia with increasing amount of exercise. And with that intestinal ischemia, you lead to intestinal permeability, which then leads to endotoxins entering the circulation, which leads to adipose tissue inflammation and hypertrophy, leading to either retention or growth of the visceral and other adipose tissue. So that's kind of what we're looking at the minute that we think is super interesting, is how the microbiome relates to endotoxemia, and how endotoxemia, either from the oral microbiome, infection, or gut dysbiosis, intestinal permeability, can lead to adiposity, cardiovascular disease, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah, we're looking to use, and what I think is interesting is that there, as we talk about with the microbiome, there's a ton of things we don't understand about that. But if we can say perhaps the key outcome metric of the microbiome, or a key outcome metric, is toxin absorption and permeability of the system. And if we could use that as a proxy to understand it, we'd be really interested to at least try doing some experiments with different levels of health of people and measure these surrogates that we think might potentially act as causal vectors for downstream problems, whether that be adipocyte inflammation or disease activation for atherogenesis or things like that.
No, I think your theory makes a lot of sense, and I encourage you to continue to take a look at that, and hopefully we can start to generate within the research community focus in on that. You know, anecdotally, we've had distance runners come in, and I've seen inflammation that I perceive on their face, and so I've invited some of them to come in to be scanned for free. And what's interesting is that they're skinny on the outside, but they got visceral fat on the inside. And, you know, they imagine themselves to be super healthy. But why do they have large amounts of visceral fat concealed within their abdominal cavity? So I point this out to them. And I used to be a medical examiner in Virginia, Corner. And so we would have these terrible outcomes for, you know, young guys that were usually young guys. With sudden death, and they would be presumably diagnosed. We just put atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease on their cause of death, and autopsies oftentimes would show, if they were done, that they in fact died from myocardial infarction. So, you know, they would have these marathoners, and one of my favorite stories is as a marathoner who came in, who was doing 8 to 10 marathons a year. I mean, that's a pretty good amount of marathons, and he was thin, and he had a lot of grit, very much an alpha type of guy, very competitive, and very thin, you know, typical marathoner kind of build. And so we scanned him, And I showed him healthy levels of visceral fat, in healthy people, absence of visceral fat and visceral fat in other people. And so we scanned him. He had a very large amount of visceral fat within his abdomen. He's only 34 years old, enormous amount of fat surrounding his heart. He took a look at those scans. He walked up to me, got like a foot away from my face and said, "I am going to be your most motivated client." That guy, on a dime, gave up distance running and became a sprinter. Now, that's a hard thing to achieve, trying to get somebody to give up distance running, because all those endorphins and the addictive qualities that go, belie, people's interest and fondness of distance running. So he walked from it and became a sprinter. And to this day, he's still sprinting. So it's fascinating to me that, we are looking at still at the year 2019, the health benefits or detriments of distance running. And I will be a voice out there saying, I think we need to look more at the detriment. And I think they're exercising too much. I agree with Nick's assessment that, people too often say, if something is good, more is better. And the other point I would make about distance running is just look at their bodies. If you look at an Olympic marathoner and Olympic sprinter, whose body looks healthier? And, they manifest sarcopenia, atrophy of the muscle and wasting. And yeah, I get that they don't, they're trying to be a leaner package maybe, but to me, it's just not, it's not grossly from a out of body taking a look, healthy man of appearance. And then when we scan marathoners, we do see a surprising amount of visceral fat and pericardial fat. So I recommend to my clients to, if they're serious marathoners, to cut back on running marathons and distance running and to adopt a practice of sprinting.
That's really interesting. I wish we could get some serum endotoxin levels in these folks. I think I'm going to have to loop in my friend who's a marathon runner. She just qualified for the Boston Marathon, so she's pretty crazy at it, but we'll have to see if her endotoxins are up. I can also send you some papers about the endotoxin levels in ultramarathoners, and they have some pretty solid increases. Same thing with the intestinal ischemia papers. I'll send you links to those.
Do you always do interventions where you do all of them at the same time, or have you done tiered interventions where you start with a diet and then if that doesn't work, you go for some of the lifestyle things? Are there any of those that have enabled you to suss out which is more important?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I'd like to be able to say that we had this, unlimited pot of funds to be able to do exactly that. But the way we have leveraged an existence, and by the way, we took our results after scanning 3,500 patients and becoming very knowledgeable about visceral fat and these important biomarkers to the National Science Foundation. And we received a grant that was very exciting. And the original granting proposal was to incorporate machine learning into studying these biomarkers and other aspects as well. But it's an awfully expensive endeavor to get involved in machine learning. And we quickly went through our funds. And so we had to turn our focus towards offering a service where we work to optimize people's health. And people weren't really interested in just trying out one thing and not getting good results. They want to do whatever they can to get as healthy as possible. Now, there are people, just the opposite. In fact, I was on a podcast this morning with a former client who runs a business podcast, and he was just the opposite. I used him as a beta. I tested him about 2.5 years ago. He was a C-level of a major corporation. He came in reluctantly because one of his good friends was just raving about me and made the guy come in and went through the study and he kind of reluctantly listened to me. And I was telling him to do all these, 20 interventions. And he basically said, I'm not buying that. He admitted to me today in the podcast it pissed him off. And he was just going to do one thing, cut out processed foods. But as a consequence of cutting out the processed foods, he felt so much better that his wife reminded him of Dr. Sean's recommendations and maybe tried doing more. So he has slowly put on more. And that guy has dramatically changed. Now, you talk about a face change. That guy has had a significant face change. His LinkedIn account, big, chubby, heavyset, obese-looking face. And now he's is this lean hunter-gatherer. I'll have to send you guys his photographs. Very interesting change. And so he invited me to be on his podcast that he calls How Did It Happen? His name is Mike Malatesta. And so he invited me to be on his podcast to explain, you know, how it happened to me, how I got interested in this field. And he told his old story. So yeah, there are people out there that, just want to do, you know, just a little bit. But in our study, the way we're operating now in our practice is that we look for people that are willing to get the best results as quickly as possible, because I'm really eager to figure out chronic disease and optimization of health. And I don't think we want to wait decades. I want to try to get the best results as quickly as possible. And I think it's going to be AI and machine learning that is ultimately going to help us define exactly that. But for the time being, that's what we're forced to work with here in Minneapolis.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I've had the I don't know, the pleasure or the unfortunate event of falling off the ketogenic diet and gaining a ton of weight back. And so I've actually done a 40-pound weight loss with keto twice. And the first time I threw the kitchen sink at it and I did tons of endurance exercise. And the second time I did essentially zero exercise by trying the same diet, which was an interesting experiment for me.
Yeah.
There were several interesting things I noted. One, there was some magical point about 12 months after I had started the diet where most of the weight had come off, where all of a sudden my energy went up. It was almost like a step function that all of a sudden I was like, I want to exercise now, which I thought was very interesting, because there is concerns for me, like you say, about impact of exercise, especially like if you're going to try to run 5 miles and you have 40 extra pounds of adipose tissue on you, that's going to destroy your limbs. But definitely, and it's hard for me to say, because obviously it was at two different times in my life and the environment was a little bit different, and one of them I was working full time, so there was a lot going on. But there were some interesting things that I noticed between doing it twice. You know, I lost the weight both times. The first time was a little faster when I was doing exercise. The second time it was a little slower when I wasn't doing tons of exercise. And then, but I just think it's interesting. That was my own personal experiment where I tried that.
Yeah. Well, it reminded me of a observation we have with patients that start sprinting with weight loss. So I'm fascinated that when sprinting gets added and it's missing, that weight loss is not as good, but not so much with distance running. When I was an obese guy, I ran 75 to 90 minutes a day. There's a lot of heavyset guys out there jogging. But sprinting really took it off for me. And I see it with my clients. So with my Asperger's, I just asked why. I couldn't let it go. So here's my thought. What's different about jogging is your body knows you're just jogging. But if you are sprinting, I think your body and your brain line up and say, this guy is now hunting and gathering. It's incompatible for them to have all this extra weight on. And so it starts shredding that weight. And so it is a possible explanation for why people dramatically lose weight when they incorporate sprinting into their lifestyle versus if they start jogging and running. So just another observation that I remembered from our study and working with clients, that sprinting is a expediter of a loss of fat.
It would make sense, because if you're doing distance running, you need to be able to store a lot of energy. Whereas if you're doing sprinting, presumably you're about to kill an animal or something. And I don't know. There are ways you could hypothesize about that and the relationship between the energy requirements or the...
Yeah, well, it's incompatible. I think if you're sprinting after an animal and you want to be able to run fast, having excess of stored fat is going to make it more difficult for you to catch that animal or for you to get away from an animal if you have too much weight. So if you're back in the game, I call it, meaning back in the game of survival. And from an evolutionary standpoint, this is called selection pressure. If your body thinks you're back with selection pressure and you're living to survive, then it will start to influence you and follow suit to whatever you're doing. And I think that's a big problem with our species today, is that we no longer have selection pressure guiding us to optimize our health. And, you know, it was survival of the fittest, 30,000 years ago, only the fit surviving got to contribute to the gene pool. And I defined that, you know, the fittest were the people that were the most resilient, ones that would run faster, run harder, run when it was hotter out and hunt and gather when it's hotter and colder out. They were more resilient. So today I explain it this way: survival of the analyst. It's guys like you two that analyze things that are going to survive and optimize. So it's the biohacking community out there, the survival of the analysts who are going to optimize and help us figure this out. And they're going to pull ahead of the other people. Just my observation. That's how I coin it.
The real question, though, is if Nathan and I make our way over to Minneapolis, are you going to give us MRIs and we can see some of this stuff? I've only gotten DEXA scans. I haven't ever done an MRI or anything to...
Yeah, I'll talk my other shareholders into skinning you guys for free if you come out here.
I think we're more than happy to pay for it.
Well, I'll be curious to take a look at, and we'll sit down and take a look at some other biomarkers too. And I'll arm you with a lot of stuff to track when you go back to follow. So we have some pretty interesting conferences out here. So perhaps it'll be something that will interest both of you guys to come out, and I'd love to meet you.
For sure.
I think we'd fly out just for the MRI, or at least I would.
Just whatever. Go over there for a weekend, yeah. See some friends.
Visit the Mall of America.
Yeah.
So on the MRIs, are you able to look at, or have you looked at people's coronary arteries? I know you mentioned the carotid and the circle of Willis.
One of the challenges with the coronary arteries is the dynamic motion involved with the heart. So we have to get people to stay real still. Now, as magnetic technology, which is the kind of defining feature to MRIs, get faster, we'll be able to scan and measure these biomarkers and tissues when there is some motion movement. Otherwise, currently, we're limited and we get artifacts. So there's a lot of, if there's disease in the coronary arteries, there's disease oftentimes in other arteries. If we find in autopsies, cerebral artery atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, we'll find it in the coronary arteries. There's a lot of correlation to that. So it's one of the reasons why people do carotid intimal measurements on carotids, is because they're not moving and the ultrasound can detect that. And it correlates very nicely, the evidence of the disease in the carotids to disease in the coronary arteries. So yeah, it's not something that's being done that I'm aware of. There are some, research level MRIs that might be able to do that.
Yeah, I think it's a software problem. I think you can do it with a standard 1.5 Tesla magnet, but it requires some fancy pants software. There was a guy on Peter Attia's podcast, if you listen to the episode with the guy who runs the whole body MRI clinic, he basically just did some super fancy tuning of his MRI machine on just a standard 1.5 Tesla magnet to really increase the resolution and the signal to noise by a huge margin, which is super interesting.
Wow. I didn't know that Peter had somebody like that, but that's obviously a related space. So I better go and take a look at that, listen to that podcast that Peter had.
Yeah, I definitely would. It was super interesting to learn about how MRIs work and the T1 and T2 weighted imaging and diffusion weighted imaging and all the crazy stuff they can do there.
Yeah. Well, I'll be eager to see what the guy's doing with it.
Yeah. Are you guys doing contrast for the cerebral MRIs, or are you able to get that without contrast?
We do it without the contrast. We do some conventional studies. Some other healthcare systems and doctors will send people into our... We have a relationship with a radiology service out here in Minneapolis that will send some patients in here for gadolinium studies. And so there is the capacity for doing the contrast, but we don't need it to be able to see it. At least it's oftentimes used for finer diagnostic changes, looking at the cerebral cortex and other other areas to kind of highlight and see if there may be tumors and things along those lines. But for the atherosclerotic cardiovascular lesions and plaques in the cerebral arteries, we don't use the contrast. And, you know, I just assume not put that into patients.
Yeah, that makes sense. The guy was saying that you can do this cerebral imaging and look at the blood vessels in the brain because you can tell using the something about the MRI imaging, which of the blood is oxygenated and what blood is not oxygenated, because its characteristics are different under the magnet, which is super fascinating. I've got to re-listen to that podcast.
We're a little bit, I mean, so we've been reading a lot about pathology of heart disease in general. And so there's concern about, I mean, obviously, it is a general rule of thumb and something to track the cardiovascular disease in other regions of the body could be interesting to look at, especially because of the association with stroke and other endpoints that people care about there. But there's some concern with looking at plaques in differing regions and making the assumption that they're a good proxy of coronary cardiovascular disease. One of the pathologists was basically saying that there are simply unique characteristics about the coronary vascular bed that it doesn't mean that there, it's not very interesting to do, but it's interesting to us to look for ways that we could potentially try and get better data directly on the coronary arteries. Because, for example, with when you feed a rabbit cholesterol, it gets plenty of, I guess, what do they call them, type 1 fatty streak lesions, but they're in the wrong place. They're in the aorta, and they actually don't get any lesions in the coronary at all. So that there's just, in the field in general, there's a lot of shenanigans is probably a good way to put it, in terms of mixing what you're calling atherosclerosis and how you define the disease and all these interesting things that we're trying to be very precise about when we discuss these things and when we're looking for research, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, it makes a lot of sense. In fact, I heard your podcast that was just recently released with Nader.
Yeah.
Loved it. I mean, you guys are just super impressed with engineers, IT background, with the capacity to articulate and comprehend the nuances of medical science in the realm of heart disease, and the manner in which you guys do. I just, as a physician, I got to tell you, extraordinarily impressed. And I thank you for your contributions. I think Nader was equally appreciative as well. But I share your perspective that I think it's a myopic view just to look for evidence of plaques. Clearly, there are more things going on involved, and there are other metrics. And I think you guys are doing the right thing. That's what I do. I see things, but I look for others as well. And I think it's an imperative that we must bring to medical science to try to get people to become optimally healthy and reverse chronic disease and begin turning this enormous ship around. And I don't think conventional healthcare is going to play a role in it. I think it's going to be disruptors, disrupted-minded people like yourselves, Jeff Bezos type of personalities that say, you know, consumers don't have to go to brick-and-mortar facilities to purchase things. We're going to do this through the internet. I'd like to see that kind of a mentality and approach get applied to through the internet to consumers. And I think we got to stop calling ourselves patients. You know, patients are people that go and spend a lot of money in a poor way with physicians and conventional healthcare. I think we're all consumers. And I think if we promote a mindset that as consumers, we want to get the best value for our money, then we'll stop going to conventional healthcare. And I think conventional healthcare might stop and, you know, doing what they're doing and change the system. But I think there's going to be transformation. I think there's going to be disruption. Somebody's going to figure out how to study biomarkers in a manner that allows patients or, you know, just said what I didn't want to do, consumers to optimize their health and reverse disease without reliance and necessity to follow conventional healthcare physicians or insurance companies that are going to tell them what tests they can and cannot do and what kind of treatment they can and cannot have or pursue. So educating consumers on what to take a look at, how to really reverse disease and become optimally healthy, I think is the future. And when some disrupted-minded business professionals figure out a commercially viable platform for that to happen, then I think you'll see a real disruption of conventional healthcare happen.
Yeah, those are definitely things we're interested in. Is there anything else you've got, Nathan?
No, I think I got through most of my questions. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Sean?
No, I don't think so, other than I'll reiterate, I'm super impressed with you guys.
We appreciate it.
I think you're on to something. I love your podcast. I just want to encourage you both to continue on. I really do hope we can meet Minneapolis or some, maybe it'll be another convention. But regardless, I certainly plan to stay in touch. I look forward to continue to be connected to you both and wish you all the best in your endeavors.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Root Causing Health Podcast. If you like what you heard, feel free to subscribe and leave us a review. Also, visit us online at rootcausinghealth.com to learn more. And please consider supporting our research on Patreon.